I'll podcast this as I usually do. Is there a way we can shut off just the front lights? This is the darkest slide. They're all actually a lot lighter after that. But yeah, that's great. That's great. Okay, cool. Well, thanks for having me up. It's been about 8 years since I gave a talk in this room. I think it was in this room. But I was talking about something slightly different at that point. I was talking about civilizations, which is some of the empirical work that, that I've done stuff on. This is a very different kind of talk, because it's a very different kind of project that I'm working on here. The title, this is the title of this book that I've been working on, Conduct of Inquiry in International Relations. It's actually used to be the title of a course, a PhD seminar that I taught at American. And I like the title so much that I decided to appropriate it. And basically, this is a book and a talk about the philosophy of science and its relevance for what we do when we actually study world politics. And in order to do this, I want to start off here with three observations. Right. So the first observation that I want to make is that if you kind of look around at various IR journals these days, there's a lot of talk about philosophy of science. These things seem to go in waves. If you do this historically by looking through JSTOR, you get these peaks for about 5 or 6 years where everybody's talking about philosophy of science, and it kind of disappears for a while, and then it comes back, and then it goes away again. And the interesting thing, of course, is that it doesn't go away because they've resolved any issues. It seems to go away for reasons that are entirely sociological. People kind of get tired of talking about Lakatos, and then he disappears for a while, and then he sort of comes back. So you get these revivals and so on and so forth. We're certainly in an upswing period right now. There's a lot more of that stuff going on now. People are actually talking about this quite a bit. And it's not just Colin White and the critical realists coming out of Britain. There are other people actually talking about these things as well. So there's more of it. But there's some odd things about the way we talk about philosophy of science within IR. And the oddest one is that it's sort of detached from the practice of actual empirical research. So people will say these sort of things about Kuhn and Lakatos and whatever, and it doesn't have any implications for how we do our work. On the other hand, you've got all this empirical work going on that seems to pay no attention whatsoever to what's going on in these sort of philosophy of science discussions. So there's this odd kind of disconnect. And the best evidence of this for me, if I can just do a sort of personal anecdote, I had this philosophy of science piece that I published in the Review of International Studies last year. And when I sent it in, both of the reviewers came back with some very positive reviews and some good suggestions for clarifying things. But both of them started out with a long paragraph asking whether or not this was IR. Both reviewers. Which, of course, the editor of the Review of International Studies said, well, of course this is IR, but that's because he's a political theorist. So of course he understood that this was IR. Whereas a lot of other people said, well, this doesn't have much to do with what we're actually doing. So there's some weird disconnects here that I always find kind of odd and disconcerting. And then the other problem with our discussion of the philosophy of science in IR is that it is extremely poorly rooted in actual philosophy of science debates. We're very opportunistic. We go, we grab, and I talk about sort of the whole field here. You know, we go and grab a particular philosophy of science theorist, rip them out of context, and use them to make the point that we were going to make anyway, except now we can attach to it the name of some exotic person in the philosophy of science. And it has to be exotic, but not too exotic. So if it's someone you've heard passing reference to before, it's even better. So like the gold standard is if you can link it to Lakatos. Oh, wow, okay, we've heard of him. We've been forced to read him in graduate school, but it was a 120-page essay, and nobody really understood what the hell he was talking about anyway. But, oh, Lakatos, okay, that's cool. That's something we ought to actually pay attention to. So that's kind of a problem, I think. If you're going to use philosophy of science, then we should use it right. So I think there's a whole bunch of different ways in which we misuse the philosophy of science. I've sort of flagged a couple of them, but let me be really precise about this. The main way I think we misuse the philosophy of science in IR is we treat philosophy of science as if it were some kind of instruction manual. As if somehow by studying not even what physicists do, but what people who think about what physicists do tell us that they think physicists are doing, somehow that's supposed to tell us how to do research on world politics. Right? And there's this sort of pervasive, I think, misconception of what the philosophy of science is supposed to do. Part of the reason why this is a pervasive misconception is because we go into this assuming somewhat naively that there's such a thing as a single scientific method, that there's some universally accepted way to do science, and that the philosophers who think about these things will simply tell us what that is. That turns out not to be the case, and not just not to be the case between the natural and social sciences, but within the natural sciences. And even within a particular natural science, the philosophers of physics still don't quite agree on how to do physics. Right? So we have these very strange, naive understandings of this stuff. And why do we keep doing it? Because it's a trump card. It's a rhetorical trump card in disciplinary debates. So I could talk about my results, and you talk about your results, and we're at a little bit of an impasse, and but I can be scientific. Boom! That immediately jumps me up in the hierarchy. And in fact, if I do it properly, rhetorically properly, it allows me to shut you down, because now you have no right to speak anymore. You're not scientific enough. You're just telling stories. You're just being anecdotal. You're doing qualitative impressionistic work. Me, on the other hand, I'm a scientist. I immediately get some cred by doing that. So we keep doing this, and the fact that nobody knows much about philosophy of science within IR contributes to the problem, because someone gets up here and tells you about these things that supposedly philosophers have said about how physics works, and we're neither physicists nor philosophers, we really don't know how to evaluate this. We're like, okay, sure, that sounds reasonable, I guess. It's very difficult to figure out what to do, because as Perry Schwartz-Shea demonstrated a number of years ago in this great article in PS, we don't teach philosophy of science in our PhD programs as a discipline. It is very rare to find the PhD program in political science that it really emphasizes philosophy of science. Some do, but they are the exception. Most of them don't. Most of them just jump right, they do a week on research design, which means KKV, and then they jump into doing stats. So that's mostly what people get for methodological training, sort of contributes to this problem. This leads to this opportunistic set of deployments that we all sort of make repeatedly over and over again. And part of what I'm trying to do with this project is stop that. I want to, in a sense, tell people who are doing those kind of things, okay, you, put down the word science, put it down, step away, 10 steps, step back, step away from the philosophy until you know how to use it. You know, come. It's almost like I want to say sometimes to people in a totally different set of projects, you know, put the math down, put down the numbers, walk away, and when you can explain to me what you're doing, then you can have the math back. And I want to do sort of the same thing here with philosophy of science. So this, I think, is the major misuse. There's another misuse of the philosophy of science, and this is this very bizarre kind of tendency that people have to look at philosophical accounts of what scientists are doing and somehow try to garner lessons from that for the substance of what we're supposed to be studying in world politics. So you get this argument, this is especially popular among a certain kind of critical realist, when they say things like, in physics, we have real but unobservable dispositional affordances that produce different outcomes depending on experimental apparatuses. And we think those subatomic particles are real even though they're unobservable, and therefore social structure should be studied the same way. Now, they lost me there in the last turn, because I have no idea why, even if they were right about subatomic particles, that would have any implications whatsoever for the study of social life. And they usually don't spell that out. So I think that there's this other sort of misuse, which is this idea of taking these things as if they were substantive. And part of that, I think, is a category mistake, because the philosophy of science is not science. Philosophy of science is a commentary on science by other people watching it. So if we wanted to take substantive ideas from science, we should take them from, I don't know, scientists, rather than from philosophers of science. That aside, these, I think, are the two kinds of misuses that I'm hoping to combat in this particular project. That said, I don't think that the answer is simply to get rid of philosophy of science. I think that's kind of unrealistic for a lot of reasons, including the fact that most of us in the United States, most of our IR studies are headquartered in places called political science departments. The term above the door kind of means that we're not going to get rid of this science notion anytime soon. Fortunately, I think there is actually a proper use or a preferred use of the philosophy of science for doing IR. And I think that this comes, the way we can use this properly is by thinking a little bit more specifically about what the philosophy of science actually is, right? Well, philosophy of science is a systematic reflection on how knowledge is produced. Right? That's basically what philosophers of science do. They take, it's to use sort of slightly technical philosophical language, is kind of a transcendental argument. They take a set of existing empirical procedures that appear within their own terms to generate reliable knowledge and say, okay, what must be the case in order for that to have generated the kind of knowledge that we then adhere to? All right, so it depends on empirical success. And it's a transcendental commentary on empirical success. Parenthetically, as Fred Chernoff has pointed out, this means that we should have a large amount of skepticism when trying to think about philosophy of science applied to IR. Last time I looked, we don't have a huge empirical success record that has to be transcendentally explained. So there's an issue here that we kind of have to confront. When the philosophers think this through, I think they provide us with some potential lessons. In some ways, first lesson is probably a negative one. which is it by sort of systematically reflecting on what it means to produce knowledge and the conditions under which knowledge is produced, we can diffuse certain kinds of indefensible claims about truth and objectivity that tend to run around in our discipline, where people make even basic category mistakes like confusing empirical generalizations with laws, confusing an observation with an explanation, those kinds of things, and then wrapping it all in the package of being objectively true, and then not unpacking what that term means. Most philosophers of science gave up on what a lot of people in political science consider to be the meaning of objectivity many, many years ago. In fact, most of the people who get cited in philosophy of science debates in IR as defenders of something like scientific objectivity are, in fact, its biggest critics. Karl Popper did not actually think that the world could be known in some categorically untheoretical state where you simply had truth with your bare hands. That was Popper's whole point, was to say, no, we don't do things like that. So there's kind of a negative use of philosophy of science, which is to defuse these grandiose claims that we tend to make for the status of our own knowledge of social life and of world politics in particular. But there's also a positive lesson. And the positive goal, which is what I want to spend most of my time here on, is philosophy of science can help us clarify the implications of particular kinds of ontological assumptions that we make, whether implicitly or explicitly, whenever we are engaged in doing empirical research. We're always making a set of assumptions about how we are connected to the world so that it is knowable. We're always making a set of assumptions about the relationship between knowledge and experience, those kinds of things. We don't talk about that all that much, but it's there and it's very important, and it structures an awful lot of the actual practices that we engage in. Because we don't talk about it an awful lot, it might be useful to look at people who do talk about it an awful lot, which is philosophers of science, and see whether there's anything useful we can gain from their discussions that might actually help us get back and do our work. And I think in some ways, the final thing philosophy of science might be very useful for, might be helping us get over physics envy, realizing that science doesn't work the way we claim it does in the social sciences, and especially in IR. The kind of thing that is upheld as scientific procedure is just not the sort of thing that actual scientists do anymore. And it's doubtful that they ever did. And if they did, it might have been Isaac Newton who did it. And it's been a long time since then. And in fact, the jury's still out on exactly what Isaac Newton was doing, right? There's still some debates about exactly how Newtonian approaches to knowledge production work. We have this kind of inferiority complex as a discipline, right? In the first instance, it's vis-a-vis economics, and then by received, it's with physics. And so looking at the philosophy of science, you kind of realize, you know, muddling through, sticking stuff together, and getting approximations that kind of work well enough in certain circumstances, and then moving on to build others, is not actually a bad thing. That's actually the way most scientists do their work most of the time. So the fact that we do that should not give us complexes. This is actually okay. So we can sort of get over this idea that somehow we should be emulating this particular kind of positivistic dream of physics, and allow us to actually focus on what it is that we do correctly. So let me break this down by giving you sort of three positive sub-lessons that I think we draw to help us with sort of this fleshing out and what these implications are for what we do within IR. I think that the first thing we have to recognize here, and this is why we're never going to get rid of the notion of science within the discipline, is because so many of our disciplining debates revolve around scientific status. And we've seen repeated attempts over the years to get rid of scientific status and say, oh, we should focus on other stuff. You know what always happens? That works for a little while within a certain sub-community, and then somebody outside comes along and says, ah, but what about science? Seems to be sort of a default position. Also because the notion of science enjoys a lot of cultural resonance outside of the discipline, so it's always available as a kind of trump card to use. So I think we have to sort of take that seriously and try, instead of avoiding science, to sort of unpack it. I think that not unpacking science tends to lead to this horrible conflation that we have of methods and methodology. We assume that research techniques and research design are the same thing. And the reason why philosophy matters to this is because methodology is enacted philosophy. This is an enacted set of philosophical assumptions about the way we are connected to the world. And if we don't acknowledge that, then we're just going to end up sort of blindly reproducing things, and I'm not a big fan of that. And the final point, which is what necessitates having to write a book about this rather than an article about this, is that philosophers of science actually haven't reached any consensus about this stuff. that there really is no single doctrine in the philosophy of science that somehow represents the philosophy of science. Now, you hear claims about this all the time, especially within IR, but you always hear claims about it from people who are advocating a particular approach. So realists will tell you that scientific realism is now the emerging consensus, and pragmatists will tell you that pragmatism is now the emerging consensus. Of course they do. A, they figure the readers don't know any better. B, it sounds a lot better than saying, well, this is kind of a minority position that not very many people adhere to, right? So the whole thing is a sort of set of rhetorical positions. There is no consensus about this stuff. It's even hard to write a textbook about the philosophy of science because there's just so many different kinds of irreconcilable things going on. So people end up just kind of resorting to chronological organization and then put in little notes about, oh yeah, and so this one has sort of happened at this period in time and not many people do it anymore, but there's still some people who do. Starts to sound familiar? Right? Schools that sort of debate with each other and never actually resolve anything and they all just kind of keep reproducing themselves. I know I've seen that model someplace previously. But there's no consensus, and so we can, instead of simply sort of making these points in an article form, it's got to actually write a book about what the diversity of this thing is like. So let me take you through some of this. When I talk about science, my solution to this problem of science and physics envy is instead of getting rid of the notion of science, what we need to do is we need to broaden our definition of science and get it away from a particular attachment to things like nomothetic law-like generalizations, or variables that are positively correlated across different attributes, or unobservable dispositional causal mechanisms that nonetheless produce observable results, at least in closed systems. But we have to get away from any sort of specific, and we have to have a much broader account of what it is we mean by science. So, what do I suggest? Well, not surprisingly, I suggest a fairly Weberian way of thinking about this, in which I think that basically science has three characteristics, right? Scientific inquiry is systematic, which means that there's some premium placed on internal consistency of premises and conclusions. Science is communal. It does not happen inside of your head. You do not simply meditate on stuff and come up with it. You have to actually put it out and make the case to other people who then get a chance to speak back to you. And the third distinguishing feature of science, I think, is that it is somehow focused on the empirical world, which does not mean all the elements of science have to be empirical. There's realists and other people who will tell you, no, 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 there's unobservable but real things out there. When I say empirical, I mean if science is not ultimately, if a mode of inquiry is not ultimately about something that exists in the world, at some point, trying to explain it, then I don't think it would really qualify as science. What this would do is it would make it difficult to talk about spiritual sciences. That's kind of harder to do because it's questionable whether or not those objects of inquiry are actually objects in the world. So that's the sort of borderline case. No problem with IR. I think pretty much, you know, we fit within there. The one area where it might get weird is when we start talking about functional progress. If you get sort of certain kinds of neo-functionalist notions of progress, which almost sound like these Hegelian kind of world spirit things, and you go, how empirical is that, really? So there might be border cases even within IR. But I think for the most part, most of the stuff we do will fit in there. And as I said, this is much more of a Weberian definition. It's much closer to the German Wissenschaft than it is to the sort of narrower sense of the English science. So systematic inquiry. And I put a lot of emphasis on that systematicity because I think that's really the thing that distinguishes what we do from, say, I don't know, what poets do. We both analyze stuff. We both generate knowledge about stuff, I think. Certain kinds of poetry is not particularly systematic. It's impressionistic, which is perfectly fine. But it would mean that nothing I'm going to say here would apply necessarily to those sorts of poets. As soon as I said that, I started thinking, well, wait, but of course there are obviously very systematic modes of poetry composition. So, you know, there's other ways in which it probably wouldn't necessarily fit. Point is that we're talking here about this broad Weberian understanding. I think if you had that, you would get rid of some of these notions, some of these sort of trump card kinds of debates, because then what we would have is we would be all sort of focus on the fact that we keep using this kind of definition of science implicitly within our work. I think this is not just for people who proclaim themselves to be political scientists, them obviously, they get the word in there, but I think it's actually implicit. It's implicit in a lot of our other kinds of claims that we make, regardless of what kind of how we self-identify, right? Whenever we start distinguishing knowledge from opinion, we're kind of implicitly drawing on the cultural prestige of some notion of science. You know, what makes me capable of writing the featured opinion piece rather than just the letter to the editor? Well, because I have some sort of credibility on my side. So there's an implicit science gesture going on there. Anyone with any aspirations to be policy relevant, and anyone who's ever either talked to sort of the policy folks down down by my neck of the woods, or read any Alexander George, realizes that exactly the currency of what we do when you get into policy circles is precisely the ability to claim it's scientific. And you go, oh, okay, cool. Well, now we can listen to them, right? There's a certain measure of authority that's associated with this. And I don't think that the definition of science that I gave, even the broad one, is going to stop any of that stuff. And of course, this has been present in IR since the very beginning. We've always been kind of concerned about this, since even before there was a discipline of international relations. Initial sets of debates and concerns have always been about scientific status. Comparative politics went through its own kind of version of this, particularly during the 1950s. So this is sort of part of our disciplinary baggage, if you will. So by trying to broaden the definition out, what I'm hoping to do here is open up a little bit more space. Space for us to really get into issues like this one, which get obscured in so much of our discussion and so much of our research training, right? What we end up doing is we conflate methodologies and methods. Now, methods are just techniques. Methods are ways of gathering information, ways of getting data and doing stuff with it. And I'm talking about things like counting, interviewing, reading, right? Ways in which we get data, right? Very basic kind of stuff. But those are not methodologies. We conflate this all the time. We talk about things like quantitative methodology, which doesn't make any sense. There's no methodological sort of bias in the use of numbers. You can use numbers to do all kinds of stuff. The fact that you count doesn't tie you to a Humean notion of causation where you're looking for cross-case covariations. These are separate kinds of assumptions. The methodology, the rationale for why you would do things in particular ways, this is where philosophy really comes into it. And we could have obscured that by not really holding that level up and focusing on it. Then we would talk about things like statistics as a methodology, not as a set of techniques. As King Cohen and Verba demonstrated a number of years ago, you don't need to use numbers to do statistics. You can do small n qualitative case studies. And it looks an awful lot like small n statistics, because guess what? It is. Because they use the same kind of philosophy and just a very different set of operational techniques. Right? Interpretation, sort of study, the study of social relations, a whole bunch of these are methodological considerations, right? Rather than being just kind of method concerns. And we skip over these things because we don't spend enough time thinking about philosophy, because we think, and again, these are related, this narrow definition of science we usually operate with doesn't have room for discussion about what would fit within science. So we don't talk about the philosophy of science. So we sort of have one kind of science, which leads to one kind of set of techniques, which leads to one kind of philosophy. And the whole package is neatly conjoined. And I think if you explode those links and open it up, you end up with something a lot more interesting. And I think we need to, because the philosophers that we keep relying on don't agree about this stuff. Right? Once upon a time, there was positivism. Properly understood, not the silly way we use it in IR, but positivism properly understood. You had basic observation statements which were logically and deductively combined, and that was supposed to give you truth. This is what people sitting around in Vienna in the early part of the 20th century thought they could do. And almost nobody left in IR actually believes this. I think David Singer might. That's about it. I mean, the Correlates of War project is very much a classical positivist project, but most of the others aren't. Most of the stuff we do, even the self-identified positivists in IR, don't do that kind of thing anymore. Instead, what they do is this Popperian hypothesis testing stuff, falsification, which technically ought to be called post-positivism, but you can't use that term in IR because that's already been annexed to something else. Within the philosophy of science, it's known as post-positivism, but within IR, post-positivism means post-structuralism, which is kind of a weird jump. But Popper, who everybody now holds up as this great defender of science and objectivity, is actually the greatest critic of the Vienna Circle earlier notion of science. So Popper's actually a revolutionary within his own context, sort of going off. And he's now become mainstream, though, within political science, to the point where we even take the old name, positivism, and annex it to Popper. If I see another reference to Popperian positivism, I'm going to rip my hair out. It doesn't make any sense, logically. But now within the philosophy of science, it got even crazier, because there aren't very many straight-up Popperians anymore. You now have realists, who argued that there's a mind-independent, if unobservable, reality out there that we can observe the implications of and abduce backwards to find out what's really producing stuff. There's critical theory, where knowledge plays a role in producing and reproducing the social order. There's pragmatism, where the importance of knowledge is its use value, its practical value. There's others as well, but those are just sort of the main high points of what you currently get. Of course, you still do have your positivists floating around. You still do have some Popperians and some reconstructed Popperians floating around. So none of these things have actually ever disappeared. They just kind of layer one on top of the other. They're all around. You can find people who will do these things still within the philosophy of science, which makes it, if you sort of just look at that picture, it looks really weird that what we do in IR is we do an odd conflation of the top two and say that's philosophy of science. You go, wait a minute, that's not even an accurate representation of what these people are talking about. And we don't even do an accurate representation of people like Popper or Lakatos. We assume that what they're doing is telling you how to do science, when what they're actually concerned about is figuring out how empirical progress can be logically possible. So it's a whole different kind of approach. So what should we do with this? What should we do with this? Can't get rid of science. Try to get rid of science. Somebody's going to come back and use it to trump anyway. Here's what I think we should do with it. I think what you should do is we should think about this not as philosophers of science, we should think about this as scholars of international relations and comparative politics. I'm writing it mostly from an IR standpoint because that's sort of the literature that I'm beginning with, but I think this is a little more broadly applicable. I think we ought to be asking the sort of grammatical question. How does it get used, and how could we improve the way in which philosophy of science actually gets used within IR? I think, I'm putting an optimistic or charitable reading on these things, I think that you could use the philosophy of science to do a constructive critique of other people's claims by saying, okay, here are the sort of internal standards that would be appropriate to the kind of work that you're planning to do. I think another thing you could do, or what you would like to get from the philosophy of science, would be a little bit of practical advice, given certain kinds of presuppositions, what might this look like? All right, so I think we could probably do that, sort of a modest kind of practical advice. Those two things, of course, are not at all what philosophers of science are actually doing. So any use of philosophy of science is going to have to read them against the grain a little bit to extract lessons that might be helpful for us from the sort of internal debates that they are involved in. This by way of saying that what we do when we talk about philosophy of science within IR is not an intervention into philosophy of science debates. It would be silly of us to think we could resolve them. We can't resolve these things. We're not part of this. This isn't our job. And arguably, some of these debates aren't resolvable. But even if they were, we're not going to be the ones to resolve them, which you would think would be sort of the same as if somebody came and tried to intervene in a set of substantive debates that we were having amongst ourselves and said, oh, well, you know, I'm going to come in with my technique and I'm going to solve this problem. We say, no, you're not going to resolve these debates. That doesn't make any sense. So we're not, I don't think we as a field should be doing philosophy of science or trying to actually solve these problems. We should be looking to see what we can gain. So, punchline. Here's what we can gain. I'm going to run through a few slides here of sort of showing you what my typology looks like. I think what we do or should do when talking about philosophy of science is we should define a menu of options that we can, and in practice already do, utilize within some of our research. This is not an exhaustive typology, and this is not particularly useful if you are already a philosopher of science. I'm making no effort to say this is, again, it's not an intervention into the philosophy of science. I'm not writing this or targeting this to philosophers of science. I'm targeting it to us over here in the social sciences. This is therefore not even a philosophical argument. It is a characterization of certain philosophical debates with an eye toward their use for us. And in particular, the way that I have gone about this is to delineate what I think of as philosophical wagers. Ways of kind of betting, if you will, that the world is constituted in particular sets of ways. So you could also think about a wager as being a provisional position on a set of unresolvable issues. And we're talking about big ontological issues here, not the sort of thing you can just sort of Wikipedia look up and figure out what the quick factual answer is. These are much more fundamental, much thornier kinds of positions. And in particular, these are issues of what I would like to call philosophical ontology, which means that most of the stuff that philosophy of science is concerned about that's helpful for us, most of that stuff falls into the realm of philosophical ontology. It falls into the realm of thinking about the hookup between the mind and the world. How are we connected to the objects that we are studying, and therefore how do we produce knowledge of those objects? So it kind of takes place in this observer-observed mind-body kind of space. This is not epistemology. And the reason it's not epistemology is because the very concept of epistemology assumes a certain philosophical ontology. The very concept of epistemology being how does the consciousness in here get to know the world out there assumes a mind-body, mind-world split. Not all philosophical ontologies actually presume a mind-world split. There's some that actually presume a mind-world unity, so there's just no problem in the sort of traditional way. But unfortunately, when we've tended to talk about this within IR, we've tended to bring it in as we talked about epistemological issues, but that presumes away all the interesting stuff. So I don't want to talk about epistemology. I want to talk about ways in which the mind is connected to the world. And in order to do this, I'm going to steal another page from Weber, and I'm going to do a kind of ideal typical dichotomy of some of these kinds of positions and say this is what's going to basically make these positions available to us in a more useful way. So, because of course, it's not going to be social science unless I can produce a 2x2. So I have a 2x2 in like two slides, and I will show you what the 2x2 looks like. The two axes of this particular dichotomy, this particular 2x2 matrix that I'm drawing, one of them is this opposition between what I call mind-world dualism and mind-world monism, which is to say a position. The dualist position is that the mind is separate from the world, and therefore knowledge is in some sense representational. Knowledge is, as Richard Rorty put it, is the philosophy becomes the mirror of nature. So knowledge becomes a way of picturing what's out there in the world, and this then leads to a whole series of procedures about trying to falsify pictures against an externally existing world, and so on and so forth. It's not the only position. The alternative to dualism is what you might call monism, which is the idea that mind is, in a sense, continuous with the world. This would mean that knowledge is not a picture or a representation of the world, but a particular kind of instrumental disclosing of the world. Right, think about it as sort of casting a searchlight onto something in particular and showing you that, as opposed to the sort of picture version, which is I'm going to draw a map as accurately as I can, I'm going to hold it up against reality and see what works. So you have a different way of thinking about the mind-world relation with different implications for how knowledge is produced. Where do you see these things? A lot of people within IR are doing dualist things. You see monist stuff, especially when you're dealing with things that are more ethnographic. You see this in comparative politics with more ethnographic work. The idea that the observer and the subjects co-constitute the reality that's being studied, that's a very monistic kind of position, because it says, I can't represent what's going on out there in the world. I'm part of it, and by being part of it, I'm co-constituting it. So again, this is sort of very fundamental philosophical ontology. Dualists tend to like testing for exactly this reason. Monists like analytical depiction. Monists tend to much more prefer kind of analytical oversimplifications, whether that's sort of content-based. Think the traditional IR example, or traditional political science example here is the Balinese cockfight. I mean, there's been other articles on the Balinese cockfight written about this, but that's the one everybody knows. You know, where Geertz goes through and says, what can I find that's a good symbol that kind of represents all the things that I think are important about this? And so he comes up with the Balinese cockfight and says, hey, this is a little window that you can use to see things in Bali. Of course, in other books, he comes up with other symbols that do other kinds of things, like the theater state notion in Nagara or whatever. Monists tend to like that sort of thing. Monists actually also tend to like sometimes very oversimplified, very precise analytics. Rational choice theory, properly understood, is not a dualistic approach to anything. It is a monist approach, because the assumption of rationality, the presumption of rationality, is not a picture. It is not a testable hypothesis. It is not something that can be improved to make it look more like reality. It's not supposed to look like reality. It's supposed to be a certain kind of oversimplification that allows you to do certain things. So that's one wager. 2x2, you need another wager. So the other wager is basically about the relationship between knowledge and experience. And I think that the dichotomy here is between a phenomenalist understanding and a transfactual understanding. Phenomenal is the idea that knowledge arises from experience. If you can't experience it, you can't know it. And knowledge is simply about looking at experience and organizing it in various ways. Where this comes out, say, within kind of mainstream political science work is in the notion that if you can't operationalize it and measure it, it's not important. So the idea that you must be able to operationalize everything, or if people say things like, you know, all of this reduces to a measurement problem, that's a real phenomenalist kind of statement. Saying, okay, well, if you figure out a way to figure what the empirical traces of it are, then you're all set. Knowledge is about ordering experience. I originally wanted to call this experientialist. What everybody heard when I used that term was experimentalist, which will tell you something very interesting about the sociology of our field, that immediately people would jump to experimentalist. The opposite of the phenomenal understanding of stuff where knowledge is bounded by experience is that what we might call transfactual, it's a term I borrow from Roy Bhaskar, a critical realist philosopher of science. Bhaskar, quite famously, argues that what knowledge does is it goes beyond experience and actually grasps the kind of unobservable structures that give rise to our experiences. And within IR, you find this kind of thing with Colin White, Heikki Patamaki. You find it perhaps most famously with Alex Wendt, who's been a pretty big exponent of that kind of approach to thinking about knowledge. Now, both of them agree, both the phenomenalists and the transfactualists agree that when we talk about the limits of experience, that's not something transhistorical. Right? There's a difference between being a phenomenalist and being an empiricist. If you're an empiricist, you think it's all about the senses, and there's only five of them, because, you know, that's the way God made you, and that's it. You're just stuck with those five. A phenomenalist has no problem saying things like, yeah, we didn't used to be able to see electrons. We didn't used to be able to see these things, and now we can, because now we have better equipment. You know, we didn't used to be able to actually see the planet Uranus, but now we can. We have better telescopes. No problem. No problem at all. So the idea is that the boundaries can move a little bit. The question is whether at any given point in time knowledge is bounded by experience or not. So let me put those two together for you and show you what the 2x2 table looks like. So if we have here, put along the top axis here, we'll put along sort of the phenomenal transfactual distinction. And if we then, in the first row, put in dualism, if you combine a dualist notion where the mind is separate from the world with a phenomenalist approach which says that knowledge is bounded by experience, what you will come up with is you will come up with what we might call neopositivism. This is what usually goes by the name positivism within political science, hypothesis testing, notions of accumulation based on successive falsifications, and so on and so forth. We're trying to get a better picture of the world. That's dualism. If we can't measure it, it's not really important. That's phenomenalism. If you relaxed the emphasis on the phenomenal and started to talk about things that are behind or beyond experience, then you would be in the realm of dualist plus transfactual. And this is, I think, what you get with critical realism, where we can say knowledge can, we can know things that we cannot see. Now, we know them because we see the traces that they leave on things we can see, but we can abduce backwards to figure out what they are in their kind of dispositional essences. There are reasons why critical realism and Marxism have a kind of elective affinity, because this is very similar to the Marxist argument about class structures and other kind of deep structures of capitalism, the idea being that you can't see them directly, but you can certainly see their effects. And because you can see their effects, you can reason backwards and therefore have solid knowledge of their existence. Right. Now, if we go to the bottom row, let's talk about monism. If we relax the idea that the mind is separate from the world and instead make the mind co-constituted with the world, if we still are reliant on experience and say knowledge is about experience, you'd then be in a little box that I might think of as analyticism, which is to say we experience stuff, we come up with these instrumental ways of organizing that experience, and then we use that to see what kind of interesting pictures we can come up with, interesting accounts we can spin out of this. Who lives in that box? Well, I think properly understood, a lot of rational choice theory would live in that box. Now, properly understood in this sense means probably about early Jan Elster and some of Russell Hardin's work, but not an awful lot of other rational choice theorists who mistakenly think that they're either critical realists or neopositivists. That doesn't make any epistemological sense. It doesn't make any ontological sense. But the other people who would live down that analyticist box would be pragmatists. Right? Weberian ideal typifications are not pictures. They are ways of highlighting certain kinds of things which allow us to order our experiences and come up with useful abstractions. Right. If you then actually relaxed both of them, and you were a monist, but you still thought it was possible to achieve knowledge of things that were unobservable or beyond experience. Oh, and parenthetically, the reason why ultimately the sort of rational choice folks would not belong in the transfactual box is because they, properly understood, don't think that rational actor notions are any sort of transcendental truth. It's a useful way of doing things. Same with the Weberian ideal type. When I talk about transfactual plus monism, what I have in mind here is a certain kind of critical feminism in the first instance. Joan Scott, for instance. The idea that you go beyond experience to grasp something that is true, patriarchy, which is not just an element of experience, but is something that underpins experience. But on the other hand, they don't want to say that the world is out there separate from the observer, because the observers are co-constituting what's going on. So they're sort of trying to flesh that out. Pierre Bourdieu likes to play in that box sometimes. There's also some post-colonial theory that likes to play down there. Some of David Blaney and Naeem and Ayatollah's work, I think, very nicely fits down there. The idea that we're still sort of we're connected, but there are ways of getting beyond just experience. Now, let me give you a cautionary note about this 2x2, which is how we shouldn't decide and should decide where one fits within these things, because I don't think there are any final or definitive answers. If I did, I would write a very different kind of book. I wouldn't write a 2x2, or if I did, it would be a slanted one, sort of slanted fitness landscape, which would then inevitably incline the reader down into a particular corner, which is the one where I would self-locate. I don't know that it's difficult, if you know any of my work, to figure out where I self-locate, but that's not the point of this particular book. I don't think there's a final answer to these things, because every way that you could think of resolving the debate between those four quadrants presumes one or the other answer. Any kind of evidence that could be adduced has been produced according to one or another set of presumptions. And evidence produced according to a certain set of ontological presumptions, not surprisingly, tends to bear out those ontological presumptions, because that's how it works. Right? So I don't think that we need a final answer. What I do think you need, and what I think individual researchers need, is a stance on where they fall, and a sort of defense, which again will be philosophical defense, of why they stand where they stand. I think in some ways, in the end, where one ends up in these particular boxes is probably a little more biographical than anything else. You know, you end up in particular places because of various things in your particular life course. I don't think that's necessarily a problem. Because again, I'm very Weberian about this, I don't think it matters how you come to a position. I think it matters that once you're there, you try as hard as possible to make it as logically consistent, internally consistent and logically rigorous as you can make it. Rather than sort of relying on the position itself to kind of recommend itself by some intrinsic set of properties. And I think what we need to do then is, in the end, we need to remember that these things are wagers. So let's take commitments, let's stand on particular points, and let's sort of see what it is that they do in practice. Let's see what kinds of things they actually produce. Let's see what kind of work actually comes out of these different kinds of contingent combinations. And maybe 30 years from now, after a couple scholarly generations have passed, then maybe we can do a big retrospective and say, okay, which one of these boxes seems to be the most productive? But in the short term, let's just have multiple boxes. And let's say, okay, this kind of work is okay to do and shouldn't be ruled out because somehow it's not scientific. It is, it just may not be the same kind of science as people are talking about in the other boxes. So we have a broader view of this, and I think we're going to be in a much better place. Now, I have some other stuff I could say, but I think I'm going to stop and open it up for questions and discussion.